Sex Bomb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I hear the voices, animal voices, the tremble of cold, the feminine abyss, and reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to After Rot. Again, it's a wonderful Wednesday, as every Wednesday is always a wonderful thing. Check out your local comic book shop and then come back here, of course, at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, every single freaking Wednesday that you are able to walk, talk, and hit buttons. Tonight, I have a guest by the name of Carol Souls. She is an author, an editor, and maker of things and thoughts and words and stuff. Hello, Carol. How's it going?
Hello there. It's going extremely well lately.
Are you enjoying this wonderful warm weather?
Well, it could be warmer, and it certainly will be warmer pretty soon since I'm going to Las Vegas.
Vegas?
And yes, it's going to be lovely and warm there.
So I understand that the StokerCon is going on this Wednesday, May the 11th, starting. Yeah. And you're going to be there because you're up for a... You're competing for some other people on a nomination for one of the Stoker Awards.
Yes, indeed. We have been shortlisted for one of the awards, and that's very exciting.
It is. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the book, which is nominated, it's an anthology, a collection of wonderful stories by all sorts of wonderful people. And it's called Nevermore, Tales of Murder, Mystery, and Mayhem. And all of these stories are influenced by Edgar Allan Poe. So the writers would have written something a little bit at the beginning of the story to explain what it was that, how they fell in love with Edgar Allan Poe, what it was that sort of drew them into that view of the world. And it was really quite fascinating to see what they came up with. As Nancy Kilpatrick and I co-edited this, had no idea really quite what we were going to get. We hoped we would get certain types of things, but we were really surprised at the wonderful things which came up. So that some people, for instance, would write stories that were clearly influenced the style and the atmosphere and all that sort of thing and the type of story, but it wasn't, you know, if you just read it by itself, you'd just think it was a great story. Other people decided that they would do a modern retelling of an Edgar Allan Poe story. So that was kind of fun. They'd bring it up to date and do things with it. And that was quite fun. And still others, I think there were a couple who sort of wrote in the style of Edgar Allan Poe. So that too was interesting. So we got all sorts of things that we didn't expect. And one of the things we got, which we did not expect, was Margaret Atwood's first story.
I was going to say, there's a wide selection of different authors who have contributed to this anthology. Margaret Atwood not being one of the first ones I would have thought.
No, this is one thing we wanted to do was, although obviously it is a dark sort of fantasy, dark kind of book, but we wanted it to draw in people from other backgrounds, from other styles as well. So we have mystery writers, we have, well, a couple of literary writers. And, of course, most of them are going to be known to the horror community.
But, yeah, most of them I recognize their names. I've seen them. They're on the Facebook. They're doing the stuffs. It's actually a really cool selection of different authors there. I mean, Tanith Lee, William F. Nolan, Jason and Sonny Brock, Nancy Holder, Chelsea Quinn Yarborough, Lisa Morton, a whole bunch of people there.
Yes, indeed. And we were very pleased with them all.
And I understand they're all original stories.
Oh, yes. These have never been seen before. And it's in a first publication from all of them, which
nice.
Is also really good. So there's no reprints in this at all.
So do you find that there's a – well, I see it in the comic book world, but do you find that there is a resurgence in the interest in the style that Edgar Allan Poe put out?
Well, there seems to be. This sort of surprised me. Nancy had a better feel for it than I did. She sort of felt that this was the time, and I guess she was right. And certainly when you look around in bookstores and such, you do sort of see there is more of this kind of story around. So that was fun to see.
Cool. I don't know if you follow movies or whatever much. I've seen a few movies now based on different Poe stories. There's one, what's his face? Oh, what the hell was his name? Crap. I don't have any notes about it because I wasn't thinking about it that way. Oh, man. Cusack. He did the one movie where he was Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that. I don't really follow them that much.
Yeah. There's actually been a number of movies over the last little while. I think there's been at least, what, four or five different adaptations of The Telltale Heart, ranging from like the 60s and forward, The Pit and the Pendulum, a few other stories like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, that whole group.
Oh, yeah.
And during the Hammer series, they did a bunch of movies, but I've heard of newer renditions similar to those as well.
Yeah.
You're going to now go and check out all those movies and find them, aren't you?
I can. I said, well, I'm going to do that.
Okay, because they are cool.
Oh, I'm sure they will be.
Well, all right. So what would you say would be – you're obviously influenced by Poe yourself, right?
Well, yes. I love that type of story, the sort of thing that, you know, is this real? Is this not real? Sort of being sucked into something sort of dark and not understanding quite what's happening to you. Love that.
Okay. So what would you consider being one of the most influential stories of his or poems of his or whichever that would be? Hey, that's the one that I would say that's that one.
I think that if you sort of the man in the street kind of interview question, I would say The Raven.
That's generally mine as well, but then I also like The Telltale Heart.
And simply because I think it's been printed in a lot of books that younger people are sort of seeing in school and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But The Telltale Heart is definitely wonderful. I mean, they're all wonderful, but The Telltale Heart and what's the other one? just meant The Pit and the Pendulum.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nancy had mentioned that she was particularly fond of the Amadillo Cask or whatever. That one.
Yeah, so, well, that's kind of nice, too.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much everything I've ever read from Poe is awesome.
Yeah, well, that's it.
It's just, okay, let's write some stuff in lyric and go like this, and then it's all like that. And it's like, I don't know what he said first time, but the second time we read it, it made sense.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was just the way I did. But moving on. Obviously, there's other things that you're involved with as far as writing and except no, actually, you know what? We're going to stay back there for a second. So the Stokers, are you excited about that?
Well, yes. First of all, the it's exciting to be up for any kind of an award.
True, exactly.
And I've been up for a wide variety, and it's interesting because I write in different genres. So this is the first time I've been anywhere near a Stoker. So that's kind of fun. And, of course, it's in Vegas, which I haven't been to before, so that's fun. And just having everybody – this and it's a new convention.
Yes, it's the very first one.
So that's fun. And I myself have founded a mystery convention here in Toronto.
Ooh, which one?
So the Bloody Words.
Okay. I've heard of that one.
We did close it down because, you know, one can't do it all the time. And there was nobody sort of everybody said, oh, I'll help, you know, but I said, no, you need to take it over because I'm now into something else. No, we couldn't do that. That's far too difficult. But anyway, so we did this for, I don't know, 15 years, I think it was. But I'm always interested to see what people are going to do with a new convention.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of fun.
Well, speaking of conventions, I think I met you the last year at Fan Expo.
God, I met so many people there.
Yeah, I think you were like deer in the headlights. These people are all, who are all these people? It's like,
not my scene at all.
Yeah, I kind of got that impression. Nancy was really into it. She stands up everywhere and says, hey, how's it going? Buy my book.
Yeah, I know. I can't do that. I'm just a real introvert person.
Gotcha. Not everybody's the same. If everybody was the same, then we would all be plastic people in little boxes, and it would be boring as heck.
No, I felt so sorry for Nancy. I thought, I'm not much help here. I'm just...
Oh, no. From so what I understand, I've seen her in action a few times. She enjoys that stuff.
I know. She's wonderful.
I mean, that's her shtick. She just loves to get in people's faces and talk about stuff.
Mm. Yes, not me.
Oh, well, okay. So are you going to be at next year's Fan Expo? Or sorry,
No,
this year's Fan
not if
Expo?
I can help it.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, I don't really see the point. We won't be having a booth, and it would be, I guess, just authors doing their thing. So I don't see the point of me doing that.
Oh, okay. No worries. So let's move on to a little bit of something else. What other types of material do you write? You said you did some mystery stuff and some other stuff. I see you have at least a handful of books that I've seen on your website showing.
Yes, well, I have written some mysteries, and I read a lot of mysteries. I guess probably primarily that I've been on the jury for various mystery prizes as well. And as a matter of fact, I am on a jury right now for one of them.
Is I was going to say, is it a hung jury?
I hope not.
It's because it's
That's
like,
not me.
well, it's we're talking Poe. He liked to hang some people sometimes too.
Well, not if I'm involved.
Oh, okay.
I just like to be a spectator of these things, you know.
Gotcha.
Anyway, so what were we talking about? Oh yeah, so I have written those mysteries, and not really much many short stories. Mystery short stories are extremely difficult to write for me,
Okay.
and you have to cram so much in. So I've done some sort of dark fantasy and such short stories, and I think Nancy and I have been in various anthologies together back in the day. And I write some science fiction.
Would that be the Danger Dance?
Yes, that's those Mercurians, the three of them, I think.
Yes, well, they had the most sci-fi looking covers that I could see in the list.
Yeah, those would be them.
Gotcha. Well, at least they had covers that would attract me. It's like, hey, I like sci-fi. Oh, look at all the colors. Look at the spacey stuff.
Oh, that's good. That's
Yeah.
good.
And then the other ones were like, I don't know what that is. No, that's okay. That one's strange, but all right. And I don't know what an Abulon dance is.
Yeah, well, that's one of the sci-fi ones.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they're basically space opera.
Gotcha.
So I mean, that's fun. And there's absolutely no science in them whatsoever, and I've gotten some rather snarly reviews talking about how could this? Of course, you couldn't have this kind of color of the sky because the gases would be blah, 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 blah. You know, and all this nonsense. I mean, who cares?
Well, in the science fiction world, and I'm sure in the horror world as well, I do this as well, but I always put it to the point where it says, if the lack of the science pulls me out, that's one thing, then I tear it apart. If it's like, yeah, I didn't really have enough details to be able to figure it out. I just sort of went with this. It's fine.
Well, my attitude is this is just the way it is.
Well, exactly. That works. I mean,
So, you know, and this is how they live, and this is what they do, and this is how they get around, and that's that.
there's some science fiction writers out there that'll just nickel and dime every single detail right down to the, and you can see the nuts and bolts in the corner of the machine, that kind of
And people
stuff.
like that. I mean, they really love that. I
Yeah.
mean, I've been to a lot of SF conventions, and you know, it's just amazing to sit there and hear them arguing about totally non-existent things.
Yes, and I am all constantly amused whenever I see anybody starting on that discussion that says, "Well, how could you have his trident go forward when it's like underwater?" And it's a fiction story, brother. It's just a story. Either deal with it or not.
I don't know. It's kind of amusing. I had a big discussion one time. I think it was Nancy Kress. We were at a convention, an SF convention. And she also writes some mysteries, I think. Anyway, we were discussing the difference between science fiction conventions and mystery conventions. And she said, oh, I think the science fiction ones are so much more fun. I really like them. Of course, I got quite insulted because I was just chair of a mystery convention at the time. Wait a minute, we have lots of fun. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, I think she's right.
Huh?
Because, I mean, mystery conventions is really a very quite businesslike thing.
I was just going to say, it's like, what's a mystery convention like? I've actually never been to one of those. I've been to horror, I've been to fantasy, been to science fiction stuff, but I've never actually seen a mystery convention. What's it like?
Well, it's obviously it's very similar. I mean, I put it together because I've been to so many of these other different kinds of conventions. I've been to a lot of mystery conventions too, and SF way back when. I used to go all the time. And so I mean, you've got the similar sort of things. You get panels, you get discussions, you get interviews with the guests of honor and, you know, that sort of thing. But of course, it's all, these are all mystery writers. And I think a lot of them are there really to push what they're doing. And not that they're going to talk about it all the time, but it's they're much more of a business-like sort of attitude towards it, whereas a lot of the other people are really more having fun. And these discussions, as Nancy Kress put it, she said, you know, it's wonderful to see people getting so excited about ideas. And they'll just stop someone on the hall and they'll start discussing about these things, which we were just mentioning, and which we might find rather silly, but they get quite excited about it.
Yeah, I have. I noticed that quite frequently. It's like you have the panel going on, you talk about stuff, and then someone will approach you later and say, hey, what did you really mean by when the cat goes on the thing? And it's like, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, and another thing, I mean, speaking of panels, you're on a panel and you'll say something and they'll say, oh, you know, I'm not sure about whether it was this book or that book or which one I prefer. And someone in the audience will leap up and say, well, as I recall, it's blah, 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 but then they wrote this and then they also wrote the other one before, but remember there was a prologue, which of course I'd forgotten all about. And they jump right in and want to be part of things. You're not going to get that in the mystery convention.
Oh, okay. So that's that. All right. So it's a little bit more.
It's a little more formal.
Gotcha. Yeah. And yeah, because I'm willing to bet you don't have anybody just jumping out in the middle of the hall and start having a Star Wars duel.
No, not liable to. No weapons.
Okay, so you don't have a couple of people dressed up Sir Arthur Conan Doyle style, saying with their pipes and whatever going. It's like, what do you think of this situation?
Well, we do have a few steampunk people floating around.
Really?
But that's, you know, that's as exciting as it gets.
Okay. Yeah, well, some of the steampunk people have some interesting ideas. And then,
oh, they do. Yeah. And they're into some of the mystery things, like the Murdoch mysteries and that sort of thing. They're quite into it. So that's fun. I'm not saying there's no fun at all, because I certainly enjoyed it, but there is a different feel to it. And, of course, you don't have any costumes and things, which...
Less fun, but still fun.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So you're Canadian, right?
Yes, that's right.
Long time, always been?
Yep, always.
Okay, so this is going to lead into the sort of discussion question about the difference between Canadian audiences and publishing and the American way of doing things. What do you think is, I don't know, this is the best way to phrase it. What do you think are some of the major differences between the way that the Canadian audience focuses on consuming books and stuff and the way the American audience does? Or am I being too obtuse with the question?
Well, I don't know how I can say that. I mean, you're talking about consuming books. In what sense you mean? Reading them or buying them or what?
I guess in the way of reading them, it's like what kind of storylines, what kind of thing. I look at Canadian culture for a lot of literature stuff, and then I look at American culture for a lot of literature stuff, and I see some significant differences between the two. And I'm just wondering, how do you work with that?
Okay, well, I can tell you right now that some of the things which I have run into myself mm-hmm. with American publishers, because I think nearly all my publishers have been American. And one of the things is, things have to be, they do not like things to be unclear. they just don't like it. I remember one time, it was an early book of mine, which has been reissued, The Mutual Understanding. And the first chapter, there was a whole, what I thought was a sort of dream-like sequence, sort of an erotic, dreamy thing near the end. And he said, so my editor phoned up and said, no, this isn't going to work because it's not safe sex. I said, what are you talking about? Well, he said, you know, blah, blah, blah. He sort of went on about it. And I said, yes, but the other guy isn't even there. What? He said. Well, I said, you have to make that clear. Well, I mean, to me, you're losing some of the stuff if you have to sort of make everything clear. But various other writers have run into this too, and I know I always call it the 2x4, you know, thing. You got to hit somebody over the head. Well, this isn't real, folks. Really, didn't happen.
Gotcha. So it's a little hard to see the the surreal sort of side of things.
Yeah, so you can't sort of do a lot of that. So I had to change it and make it clear, you know, in his mind he saw or whatever, you know, and I just got so cross about it. And the same thing about endings. They don't like endings that are not clear. You can't just, and I notice Canadian writing tends to do a lot of that. You know, it's not that it's not clear, but it could be this and it could be that. It's everything's not all tied up neatly.
Gotcha.
Whereas I think Americans tend to more, this is very broadly speaking, of course, tend to want to have things clear. Did he go or did he not go? You know, you can't just have him sort of looking at the door.
So you mean it's like The Walking Dead, whereas who did he kill?
Well, yeah, you know, you can't just sort of leave things nice and murky the way I rather like it.
Okay, well, no, I can totally understand that because the public reaction on The Walking Dead on last season was like, why can't we're going to Congress. We want them to demand to tell them who did it. And it's like, are you kidding me? It's a story.
Exactly.
Wait for it. It'll come around again.
Yeah.
No, I thought that was rather amusing when I kept hearing about that. So that was funny. That's an interesting perspective. I mean, I had never actually personally considered the difference in that manner. That's neat. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, that's sort of the thing that sort of hits me right away. As far as the reading things, I mean, there's an awful lot. I belong to the Dorothy L list, which is about 3,000 strong, and there, you know, 2,900 of them are American.
Okay.
They read a lot. These people,
right,
and discuss in a very sort of, you know, not at all in an elementary way. So that's sort of one quick look into a small group of people. Although mystery books are one of the top genres, I guess, in selling.
Really?
Yeah, they are. They're not the top because that's, I think, romance probably.
We won't talk too much about romance.
No, we won't talk about that. I tried to write one. I did try and write one. Oh, dear.
I don't think I'll ever personally try to write one myself, but...
Well, that's unusual. Probably everybody I know has tried to write a romance novel.
No, I already know. It's just no matter how hard I try, it's like, do-do-do-do-do. No, sorry, I'm not going to even waste my time doing that because I don't think I can. YA? Sure, I'd give a shot at that, but that's...
No, that's one thing I haven't tried, YA.
Well, that seems to be from what everybody I've heard from is saying. That's where the money is nowadays.
The money, I know. Everybody told me that. Come on, get with it. But, of course, I just know that I mess it up.
Well, I mean, I look at Harry Potter, and I'm not a big Harry Potter fan myself, but I can see how it stimulates an entire renewed interest in fiction for younger people. And I think that part of it is cool.
Oh, I do, too. Harry Potter, to me, I mean, when I just sort of looked at it and I was reading away and I thought, okay, this is basically, it's a boarding school story with Dickens, you know, cast of thousands. And I thought it was quite well done, but that's what it is.
It's a solid series. It's a solid story. I can't read that way.
No, I don't read it either, but I couldn't write it either. But once I saw what it was and how it worked, I thought, okay, that's fine. I get it now.
Yeah.
But no, I don't. I couldn't write YA mostly because I don't really know young people enough anymore. You know, I used to teach, so I was with it for a while.
Oh, okay.
But I used to teach at university, and then I taught high school. So then I could have done it, but I can't do it now because I haven't taught young people for a long time.
Okay. Well, they're still pretty much the same, and then they're really off the reservation nowadays.
Well, yes, but it's the way people talk that is the problem with writing.
True.
Yeah, I couldn't do.
All the LOL speak and the text dialogue, and what's the other one, I-339 or whatever they want to call it?
Good Lord, what's that?
It's various sub-dialect languages for talking and texting. It's just there's so much out there, it's like, who the hell comes up with this crap? Somebody did. Shoot him. I'm just saying.
It's really quite fascinating. There's so much. I mean, one can do almost anything these days.
Yep. Oh, did you hear recently about the criminal suit going on right now from Paramount and this group of people who are doing a fan fiction movie, and Paramount is suing them for using Klingon?
Oh, yeah, I think I heard about that. Good Lord.
I started laughing my butt off when I started reading that. It was like, it's a made-up language that you created 1,200 words for your TV show, and the rest of the world has gone and taken and made that an entire language of thousands and thousands and thousands of words.
Well, there's dictionaries and everything out there.
Exactly. Yeah. There's school classes on it.
I know. Well, a friend of mine is really into it.
Well, I mean, some people are into it, but whatever. Each to their own and all.
I don't see how you can trademark something like that.
I can understand how they trademark the idea. Klingon is their language, fine. But I can't see how you would trademark that language.
So, technically, you can't trademark a thought, an idea.
Exactly. You can just the name.
Yeah, the name maybe you could. Anyway, it's pretty stupid of them. I mean, what's the point?
Exactly. It's just, okay, is this supposed to be a marketing scheme just to push the name out there? And it's like, oh, create some negative buzz so it creates some positive buzz?
Huh.
Maybe. Marketing machines are weird. They just think so...
Oh, very strange. Yeah.
Very. Yeah, it's like the straight line goes from here to here, but we can't go straight, so we have to go in a circle. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've talked to some marketing people before, and it's just all buzzwords and stuff, and it's like, do you actually have a person inside that brain? I don't really know if there's one there.
Yeah, very, very odd.
Can be. But let's move to something a little bit more relevant. Actual physical publishing. I mean, the nature of publishing and literature and whatever over the last few decades or whatever, century now, has been really strongly changing over the last 10 years or whatever. The difference between publishing through a traditional publisher and publishing through self-publishing. Hello.
Yeah.
Did we lose something?
No, something just fell over here. Sorry.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe something jumped out of the corner. I was like,
No, not yet.
Okay, cool. Yeah, well, when they do, just make sure to call Harry Potter because he'll fix them.
Okay.
Snap him with the wand. Self-publishing. I mean, there, in the horror community, I keep hearing a lot of negative. It's like, oh, you self-publish, you must be bad. It's like, well, not necessarily, but there's a lot of people who have a stigma associated to self-publishing. And then there's also a gradual, hey, traditional publishing is a bunch of dinosaurs. It's like, whoa, it's got to change. Where do you... Do you have any thoughts or feelings in the difference between the two forms?
Well, yes. I think to begin with, there was a great deal of feeling against self-publishing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we sort of feel, who's the gatekeeper? Who's the person who is checking that this is actually makes sense and all the rest of it? But it seems to be fading because some people are doing quite well at this self-publishing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing it right. Like everything else, there's a right way to do it, and then there's the wrong way to do it. And if you're going to get yourself edited and get yourself a good designer to do covers and stuff, then it's going to look professional, and it's going to make some sort of sense, and it's got a chance. So I think now it's a matter of the cream sort of coming to the top, and everybody else is going to sink because of, you know, so what's the problem? Because I know naturally in various writing organizations, because I belong to quite a few, this has come up. And some organizations will not let in self-published people. I think MWA doesn't.
Really?
They have a list of publishers, and you have to be published by whoever these people are. And because I belonged to them for a while, and thank God my publisher was on there at the time. So they've since gone, but never mind.
Yeah, that's okay. You're still on there. It's all good.
Okay, I'm still in. So, you know, that's their way of doing it. And now the Crimers of Canada, they just say, you know, well, they're writing, their writers just come on in. So that's fine. So they're letting everybody in without sort of too much commotion.
Mm-hmm.
And now I also belong to the TWUC, you know, the Writers Union. Which is interesting to sort of say we're sitting there waiting to see what they were going to do because this is the big Canadian, you know, literary establishment group.
Mm-hmm.
So they have come up with something which I think is very sensible. And they say that anybody who is self-published has to submit to a jury. So, and I was on that jury for one of the first couple that came in. And, it was, and I thought that was very sensible because this is a jury of peers, know, all these other writers, and to see whether it was. And they had various, you know, suggested questions that you could give to yourself about. Basically, they just don't care whether it's a good book or a bad book. They want to know if it's professional.
Oh. Well,
it's because it's a professional organization.
Right.
I mean, you know, we can't all write really good books all the time. Some of us, let's face it, the books are not that great, perhaps, as they could be. But anyway, the first one that came in, I mean, was a thumbs down book, as far as I was concerned, because it hadn't been edited. And there were big glops of it that should have been taken out. And it was repetitious. And there were mistakes in the way that the formatting was done. You know, all this sort of very...
The basic stuff.
This is basic stuff, and it's stuff that's going to pull you out of the story. You mentioned a lot earlier about various things pulling you out of the story. And
right.
This is what pulls one out of the story. If, you know, you get half a line here, and then it jumps down to the next line, this kind of thing. It's just not professional. So that poor soul didn't get in.
Well, this time around. I mean, he can
do something
and do it again, right?
Sure, fix it up and do it. I don't know what they say to the poor thing, but anyway.
Oh.
The second person did get in because it was nicely done and it looked nice and it read well, and you know, so I thought that was an interesting way of dealing with it, because I know that there was some talk in various organizations about losing their professionalism. You know, if you let all these people in,
well, you know. The whole point of being part of a professional organization is to network and build upon what already exists from that organization to build yourself up as well as the organization, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I think that was a bit, but you still have to have a certain amount of credibility as an organization.
Right.
If you have a group which is, you know, half of them are, you know, published by iUniverse.
Okay.
You know, this is not going to look good for the organization, I would say. I mean, you've got to think about it from the other way around. I've been on, you know, on headings of the, you know, guiding some of these things.
Oh, steering committees.
Steering committees. Thank you. So I had perhaps a different way of looking at it than other people would. But anyway, I think it's wonderful that the publishing has moved in that direction, because now some people can just get published a lot earlier and not have to wait around for years and years and years, as most of us did, mm-hmm. doing the rounds. And I mean, if they're really good, they can get somewhere. And as long as they realize that, you know, they're going to have to do a lot more than just write the book.
There's also another segment to it, which is the difference between if you are self-publishing and you actually apply yourself to it, you can go sky's the limit, because it's all about how much effort you put into it to push that, to get it down.
Exactly.
And whereas if you're being traditionally published, there's always, we all know that there's the caps on how much they invest in who's going to get where and what, simply based on, well, this writer over here, he makes a crap ton of money for us. We support him much more than we do this guy over here, who's just fulfilling a Canadian requirement law sort of thing or whatever.
Well, yes. I know we used to say, well, it depends on how much is your advance. You can tell what they're going to do by how much give you as an advance.
Right. And that mythical advance thing that you're talking about there, do you still see that around?
Kind of mythical these days, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, oh, I've yet to hear of an advance being thrown around. Oh, I heard about these. I read it in a book once.
It's getting to be that way, yes.
Yeah, and I think that's largely affected by the way that the dynamic nature of the immediacy of publishing on the internet or whatever and everything else along those lines. But eh.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, the big publishers are giving advances, but
still, yes. But again, to that, I don't know what we call it, the 5%.
Well, yes, probably
something like that. I mean, definitely Stephen King. I'll always go by the horror and the science fiction side of things because that's more where I'm familiar with.
Oh,
but yeah, the Stephen King, he's always going to get the advance because no matter what, he just has to put his name on it; it'll sell.
Well, sure. I mean, it is a business.
Yeah.
So that sort of makes sense. But even if you are published by a publisher, whether or not you get an advance, you still have to do a hell of a lot of marketing these days.
Yes.
I remember being shocked when I've forgotten even what publisher it was, when I got with my contract this big, long 8, 10, 12 pages, whatever it was, of things which basically getting me to tell them what the marketing strategy was. It was very interesting because, I mean, that had never happened to me before. And they wanted all my contacts for radio, for TV, for whatever, if I happen to have any. And, you know, it was shocking. I thought, well, isn't that their job? But no, apparently not.
Okay, that was an interesting news side that I haven't heard of before.
Oh, yeah. It's all kinds of interesting things going on.
Yeah, I have heard about a lot of publishers look at your social media footprint and say, ah, look at that one. That one's got lots. That one's like, ooh, that one's got three. Let's focus on this one that's got lots for a bit kind of thing, you know?
Like,
I've been hearing a lot more of that.
Yeah.
Well, cool.
I'm sure you're right about that.
The social media. I mean, personally, I don't necessarily think social media itself sells anything. I think it's a good leverage to help engage potential customers and to just sort of create the value that lets other people know. It's like, hey, that's an actual interesting person. I could actually talk to them once in a while, exchange ideas without actually having to meet them at a convention. It's just random. But that's because I like to play on Facebook and not everybody else does.
Oh, well, I enjoy it. I mean, I keep track of various people that way, and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't use all of the facets of it. Probably don't even know them all.
30 spitting images coming out. It's like, what? Yes, I know. I've seen some people on Facebook do some amazingly crazy. Well, I think that's too much work. I'm not doing that.
Well, yeah, there's that too. I mean, really.
Yeah, it's like, okay, well, I'm not really planning on getting rich for writing, but I'll do what I can. Yeah. So, moving to more of the traditional style of, hey, you're an author, what are some of the sources of inspiration you get for writing when you're doing writing?
Well, it comes, the inspiration just comes from so many different places. I mean, sometimes you might just hear a song which gives you an idea. Maybe that happened once.
Mm-hmm.
Another time, for the inspiration for The Tangled Boy was a story in the newspaper. Just a very short little story, a little thing about something that happened up northern Ontario somewhere, and about a young kid was seen running away. And I thought, okay. And that was the essence of giving me the idea for this story, which usually I put this together with something else, you know. So that was the kernel of the thing, which was fun.
Cool. That sounds very Canadian, by the way, that premise.
Oh, does it?
Oh, I don't know. It's just, I was throwing that out there, a random thing.
Somebody running away in midnight?
Yeah, it's like, oh, I just want to get away from this. Werewolves! Okay. No, not that. That was, but, yeah.
That was the Tangled Boy, I think. But, I mean, it just comes from everywhere. It just comes from listening to people talking. Sometimes you think, well, that's interesting the way they're talking and what they're talking about. And just reading sometimes you'll think that character is talking about something which I was interested in before, and I think I should go and take another look at it. And, you know, all sorts of things.
Cool.
But I love music, so I get a lot of inspiration from that.
I was just going to say, well, I know a lot of people say that they listen to music while they're writing. Is there a certain frame of mind that you're in when you're listening and doing the writing? Do you listen to the heavy metal music, or do you go more classical?
No, I'm basically a classicist.
Okay.
So, you know, and I love opera and all that sort of thing. So that's what gets me going.
I'm going to throw a random thing at you, which may or may not work for you. I'm a heavy metal person with a whole lot of other musics as well. But have you ever heard of a band called Apocalyptica?
No, I haven't heard of them.
So they're basically a cello band. It's four cellos.
Wow.
These guys just play cellos. It's really heavy music. But they cover, or their original claim to fame was that they covered Metallica's The Black Album.
Really?
With four cellos.
Good heavens, I can't see it.
It really surprisingly works really well as classical music and as heavy metal.
Gosh, that's weird.
So if you get the opportunity, check them out.
Well, my big claim to fame of the heavy metal thing is I did take my son, who was really keen on it at this point. He was quite young. He was about 12 or something. And this band came to town. Oh, he was dying to see them. And let me see, what were they called? Motley Crue. That's what they were.
Ah, nice band. Hair metal band.
They were. He was keen on that. So off we went. And I thought I was going to have a brain aneurysm or something. God. Between the extreme loudness of the thing and the pot smoke, me sort of wondering, how is my son taking in all of this? I don't know.
yeah. Young people, they got to get through their stages and stuff.
So then the next thing we went to, I think, was AC/DC.
Excellent choice. AC/DC's a nice loud band.
They certainly were.
Yeah, but they're not the loudest band out there. Motorhead was.
Well, thank God after that he was old enough to go by himself.
Exactly. It's like, yeah, you want to lose your hearing? Go ahead. Yeah, no, it's all good.
So, oh, it is.
So in the methodology for the writing, do you create yourself a space that says, this is my writing space?
I do, actually. Back when I started writing, which was basically in the 80s, because before that I was too busy teaching and writing, you know, academic stuff.
Right.
And so I was just sort of perching on chairs and corners and just doing it everywhere. Because I guess it had all kind of built up in my head, you know, so it didn't really matter. But eventually I had to sort of stop and think about it a little bit more. And I got my own space and my own room and my own place to sort of, and that's all I did. And then I went through a period when I went to Starbucks. I wrote a whole book at Starbucks.
Yeah, I've heard some people do it that way. I can't do it that way.
It seemed to where, I don't know why, I think that because my room became, I guess because I was running the convention, and I was doing that in the room too. And it became too much. Every time I was there, I was thinking of convention stuff instead of writing. So I thought, I have to get out of here. So I went to Starbucks and, you know, darn, it actually worked. Had a lovely time over there writing. Also found out all sorts of interesting things about the people who go to Starbucks.
Exactly.
I had no idea this sort of subcultures exist.
It's
Starbucks, you know.
Yeah, I'm a pretty much non-Starbucks person myself. But yeah, I've heard some stuff. A triple latte thing, and it's like, no, not me.
Yeah, but it's not that so much. It's that, you know, people are having meetings. People are having counseling sessions for, you know, for troubled youth or whatever it was. And people were having a lot of drug reps, you know, pharmaceutical reps seem to hang out in Starbucks and have in there.
Well, caffeine is one of the biggest selling drugs in the world, right?
I tell you, so there they were, slurping it up and having these meetings, and thought, wow, this is just, who knew this was going on? I just thought people dropped in for coffee and a little read. Well, no, apparently not.
Well, that's, okay, I'll go with your original assessment. That's what I would have expected.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, well, okay. So, in the same vein as the traditional kind of question marks, do you consider yourself a plotter or a pantser?
Oh, good question. Of course, I taught writing for a while.
Oh, okay.
And I was very strong on teaching structure and plot, right? Because that is my weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started out, I just started writing. You know, you write and you just sort of, it just kind of goes. And then eventually, of course, it kind of falls. It's like kind of trying to build a bridge when you don't really know how to do it. And eventually it's going to fall down. You don't quite know what's wrong with it.
That third straw is out of play. Oh, crap,
exactly.
It fell apart.
Something's wrong with it anyway. So I tend to be quite strong about trying to get people to see that you do need structure.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you don't want to get so hidebound that you're not going to be able to write, worrying about whether or not you're at the end of Act 1 or Act 2 or whatever the hell it is, or which plot point you've gotten to or whatever. You know, you don't want to do that. So it's kind of a tightrope between just let it all out first.
So it's the balance equation.
I think so. And I think you just got to let it out first and then say, okay, I've got this stuff. Basically, this is just like the clay of the potter. Now I've got to start forming it.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's the way I see it.
So In the same vein, seeing as how you are a classist, as you were saying, do you think it's more important or equally important or less important to be grounded in more structured traditional forms of actual writing versus just going complete random? I mean, I've seen some stuff out there is like, that's like more of a poem than it is an actual story. And then some stuff that's just like a blog entry, but it's still popular enough to be as a story. I mean, in the same vein being with musicians, some of the original classical heavy metal bands were all classically trained musicians, and that helped them build their music format to change. But nowadays you find people in punk, it's like they don't even have an idea how to play their bands, but they're still getting popular and doing well. If you follow what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, I do. But I still think it's rather useful to have some kind of formation, idea of foundation, so that you can then go off and do your own thing. It's like painters can be as abstract as hell, but most of the time they've had some kind of grounding and they had a place to start. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, some of that type of writing that you were mentioning, I would sort of not want to say anything about it because I don't understand quite what they're doing. And I know there are things beyond my ken, as it were. So, you know, just as far as I'm concerned, I just leave it alone, let other people decide what to do with it.
Oh, okay.
You know, for instance, I do a lot of, or was at one point doing a lot of manuscript evaluations and that sort of thing. And some of them I would simply turned down because I don't understand what they're doing and I don't understand the format. So I'm not the person for that person.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, that makes perfect sense as far as I would off the top of my head, and I'm sorry, but I'm going to kill something right now because I just saw it walking.
Well,
ants.
We can't have that.
Ants. Ants have to die. Look at the size of that one. Sorry. That was a completely random non sequitur that I usually would not necessarily put on an interview, but there it is.
Well,
you've been specialized.
Good.
It's only happened once other time in the 200 episodes I've done.
Aha, uh-huh. Well then.
It was actually my most popular episode, too. Okay. So we got writing, we got doing stuff and other stuff and everything else like that. The question mark would normally go towards the lines of, do you see the connection or interconnectivity of today's modern connected world and the way that we write? And I might be being a little obtuse there, but the idea being, I see society as a whole thing that's kind of generally going to a much shorter time frame, much shorter attention span. And the way that we're writing, I was just seeing an article from Tor recently that says, hey, we're going to be doing more novellas because we think that's going to be the future of novels.
That is the future of novels. It's happening right now. Everybody's doing novellas.
Right.
And matter of fact, it was the Crime Writers of Canada had to add the novella category. Never had before because there's so many of them. And that's exactly why. And it started out in Canadian publishing, as far as I know, with, I think it was Orca. And they talked about it being easy readers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was years ago because we met the editors at a convention and she was telling us all about this. And boy, were they paying good advances. It was amazing.
Oh, nice.
But anyway, that's sort of, and I sort of thought, well, that's fun, but it's just sort of for, as you know, people who have difficulty reading actual books. But it isn't.
Yeah.
It quickly evolved into actual novellas, and just that so people could read them on subways or whatever, and quite quickly, and
right.
It didn't take a whole lot of concentration to do it.
So in that same vein, do we think that anthologies are making a big comeback again? Because it's like, oh, hey, I can just read one story on a trip to work. It's an easy read, a 10, 15, 20-minute read or whatever.
Well, I do hope so. I mean, traditionally, anthologies have never made pots of money.
Exactly. Well, it makes some money for somebody, but not for everybody else.
Well, not really. I mean, traditionally, they don't sort of sell as well as some other things.
Right.
No, you know, once again, unless you've got sort of a Stephen King anthology or something like that. But
or yes. An Edgar Allan Poe anthology.
Yeah, well, we'd hope, yes. But yeah, I think that's a good idea. On the other hand, they're still the size of a book. Mm-hmm. Whereas these novellas are small, you know, that's another thing.
But more and more people are reading on their devices, their electronic devices, on their phones, on their iPads and stuff like that. And so who cares the weight? It could be 300 pounds.
That's very true. I know. Well, my daughter does that. She reads on the phone. I can't read on the phone, but I do read the, you know, e-books.
Right.
They're wonderful for traveling.
Well, yeah. I mean, you want to read, but I feel like reading something really dumb. Okay, let's read that one. All right. I'm tired being dumb. Let's get something educational. It's like, oh, okay, that one. I love the idea of e-readers myself, but I don't have enough time.
Well, I use it mostly when I'm traveling.
That makes sense.
Because I used to be always packing books, and then, you know, I'm terrified of running out of something to read.
Oof, can't have that.
No, you know, I end up in an airport trying to buy a book.
And your limited selection there is like, they've only got space for 100 books, so it's just going to be the top 10.
So that's why I'm keen on ebooks. I think it is a different experience reading an ebook than it is from reading an actual book, and I much prefer the actual ones.
I fully understand that, because I just look over there and look at my shelves and like, yeah, I have a couple of books over there to read.
Yes, indeed. Aisle of TBRs.
Yeah, I'm not even going to go there. It's either TBR, TB watched, or TB heard.
That too, yeah.
So many things, so many choices.
Well, that's another thing. We are surrounded with so much stuff and mm-hmm. so much going on and so many avenues of entertainment. It's mm-hmm. it's just completely different.
So do you like to read new authors, or do you like to read people you've pretty much already gotten used to? It's like, I like the way that person writes, so I'm just going to keep reading their books when they keep putting them out.
Well,
or a little of both.
I think it's a little of both, but mostly I am interested in, you know, if people are talking about a certain book, or I read about it somewhere, or somebody says something that catches my fancy, and I take a look at it, and I thought, that looks good. So, I mean, there's a lot of that. I also like to read something that might be up for an award, just to see why it was up for the award, or if I agree, or whatever.
Gotcha.
I do some of that. And I also belong to a book club, which is, it's kind of a strange book club.
They still have book clubs around?
They have. This one's been going for 11 years. It's almost all Latin American women. And so it's in Spanish.
Pretty specific subgroup.
It's very, yes, and they're an amazing group, but they read very widely. And so I get caught up reading some books which I would never read ordinarily, because such as nonfiction, for instance. I'm not a nonfiction reader usually, or of memoirs or things like that. It just doesn't interest me. So I've read some of that. And so it's quite fun. And these women, they actually discuss the book in great detail. And it's amazing. So once a month I have this.
Something to look forward to. It's like, hey, let's talk about this and let's listen to this. It's like, oh, cool.
Let's talk about this. And as long as it doesn't go on too long, at which point I begin to not understand what they're saying. And some of them are from, there's two of them from Argentina, which is a very specific accent, which is sometimes difficult for me. But anyway, okay. So I'm the only one lisping away in Castilian.
Okay, I'm stuck in English for the most part, and unless somebody starts speaking Latin, I'm pretty much only going to be stuck in English myself.
Yeah. Hey, I used to teach Latin.
Oh, yeah? Oh, okay. I actually was pretty good in Latin for a while, and then it got harder. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, I love Latin.
Well, I always liked Latin because it was the good subsource of most of the English language.
Well, exactly.
It's like Latin and Greece. I should probably have learned how to do Greek, but I never got around to it. And Hebrew would have been good, too, because those three build most of the English language, right?
Well, I don't know about Hebrew. I do know about Greek.
Yeah.
Yes, I did a little Greek, but not much.
Yeah. Well, good, clean fun for everyone, as it were. So if you were to recommend people to read stuff, what would be some of the newer authors that you'd be inclined to suggest?
Oh, dear. You're going to ask me that?
Some. Not a lot. Just like a couple. Don't pick up like 30 of them and say, oh, I got to mention everybody.
Well, no, because, of course, I can't remember people's names. This is the trouble. I have to sort of look things up.
I got you.
Yeah, this is a problem.
So I can talk about this really cool dragon I got over here last weekend. It's like it stands 18 inches tall. And it's got like a wingspan of about like 12, 15 because the wings fold in while you go and find the names that you're looking for.
Good.
That's actually pretty cool. It's like an action figure, but with no moving parts. I could kill people with this because it's got all these sharp, shiny parts.
Well, what an idea. I'm just going to take
it. I don't know. I thought it was neat. It was $10. What are you going to do? Turn that down? No.
Oh, where did you find this wonderful thing?
A flea market, actually.
Oh. You see, I mean, I read strange things. Like right now I'm reading, you know, La Casa de los Espíritus, The House of Spirits.
Nice. Sounds like Dead Things, which always gets me going.
It's an old book, you know. It's Isabel Allende. So, and I like, you mentioned reading people whom you know.
Right.
And one of the people that I always read is Donna Leon, who writes about Venice. She lives in Venice.
Okay. It's a good thing to do, write what you know.
Yeah, so she certainly knows it. And so this is the Commissario Brunetti, and it's, you know, he's the police guy there. So, I mean, every time, as soon as she gets a new one out, I read her. So there, I was just thinking that when you were saying, talking about this, oh, I don't really do that anymore, but I do. At least with Donna Leon.
Yeah, I used to have a whole group of different authors that if they put out a book, it's like, I got to get it.
I did too, but now it's down a lot. I do check up on Maureen Jennings, what she's doing too. But that's certainly not a new writer.
Okay.
So.
Well, there's a couple minutes left for the show, so throw it out there. How should people find you and find your stuff, and what's the best way to do all that modern-day fun following stuff?
You know, I've got the not very inspiring webpage.
And what is that?
Which is the carolsouls.com. And it's I haven't kept it up. I really must do something because I've been so busy. With the Nevermore stuff was a lot of work.
Yes, I would imagine it would be. You got like 23 different authors you got to play with and work them all together and make sure everything connects.
Then we did the tour afterwards, so that was great fun. But you know, you're not worrying about your website at this point. So, but I mean, it's there, and I am on Facebook, and I am not on Twitter much. I just keep forgetting about it. I don't quite understand what it is, but anyway.
140 characters of fun right in your face, and then it's gone.
It's not, you know, what can you do? But anyway, I keep thinking, well, where does it go? I don't know where it's going or who's looking at it or if anybody's looking at it. But anyway, but I'm certainly quite visible otherwise.
Excellent.
So you could find me there.
Okay. Well, and is there anything else you'd like to say to anybody out there in the wide, wide world of hello, electronic peoples?
Well, definitely pick up a copy of Nevermore.
Exactly. That's the whole point of the discussions and stuff.
Well, I know. I keep forgetting what the point is because we're having such a good time. But I just don't want people to forget about this wonderful anthology, which is quite different from a lot of things that are out there. So do take a look at it. And it's available just about everywhere, I think.
Excellent. Well, Carol, thanks for joining us on After Rod. I appreciate it greatly, and I hope your book goes well, and I hope you get the win going in with the Stokers.
Well, thank you very much, and I've really enjoyed the conversation.
And I'm sure even if you don't win, you're still going to have fun down there anyways, because there's going to be a crap ton of people there.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thanks a bunch. Have yourself an amazing one, and everybody else in After Rod land, by all means, check out Nevermore. Come back again every Wednesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and have an after-rotten good time.
You're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their peace.